You're listening to Discordia, over 50 years of student activism at Concordia University. On CJLO 1690 AM or online at cjlo.com.
My name's Piper, and I'm an independent artist, musician, and academic invested in researching alternative modes of storytelling. I live, work, and create within the unceded lands currently known as Montreal, and I'm currently enjoying engaging in forms of education and knowledge sharing situated outside of the academy after completing my master's thesis here at Concordia in spring of 2024. My background in campus community radio spans over a decade across several stations, and I'm very pleased to be here at CJLO, co-producing Discordia for you.
I'm Sydney. I'm originally from Cataraqui or Kingston and have been living in Jojage since 2010. I recently finished a PhD in interdisciplinary humanities at Concordia on the rise of magic, astrology, and related occult practices as resources for community building and political work in Montreal. I've done talk radio on antennas and CKUT, and I think of radio as a perfect methodology and companion to community-based research and activism. I'm looking forward to delving into the archives, making connections with other activists, and finding through lines in student solidarity movements in Montreal over the last half century.
I'm Serena. I was born and raised in Lebanon. I'm a student at Concordia University, majoring in journalism and minoring in English literature. I'm also the news director at CJLO. I have been involved at the station for over a year now, producing extensive coverage on student activism for Palestine, as well as other community-related events. Radio has given me the opportunity to platform voices that often get censored by the mainstream media and enable more powerful means of communication with society. I am very happy to be partaking in the making of this episode with Piper and Sydney.
The first day was incredible. Basically, it happened all at once. People just descended on the lower field, and I think at first it was around 100, 150 people who were all prepared to set up, and people just descended on the lower field and started setting up tents, and I think the entire thing was set up in 10, 15 minutes. And then what happened is people formed this massive ring around the tents, holding arms together, and created sort of like a chain around the fence. And of course, at that time, McGill security had no idea it was coming. They didn't know what to expect. And once people in Montreal started hearing about that, by the end of the day, we had thousands of people outside the encampment. People were playing drums, people were giving speeches, people were chanting. And I believe a citywide protest organized by the Palestinian youth movement came as well. And after that protest ended, people stayed there and people brought food. And it was really a wonderful community moment.
Free, free, free Palestine!
Free, free, free Palestine!
Free, free, free Palestine!
United! United! We'll never be defeated!
The students, united, will never be defeated!
The students, united, will never be defeated!
In response to the escalation of Israeli force in occupied Gaza following the events of October 7th, 2023, which has since been acknowledged by groups like Amnesty International as an ongoing genocide, solidarity encampments began to spring up across university campuses in North America.
From April to June 2024, a series of occupation protests by pro-Palestinian students occurred at Columbia University in New York City, in the context of the broader War on Gaza protests in the United States. The protest began on April 17, 2024, when pro-Palestinian students established an encampment of approximately 50 tents on campus, calling it the Gaza Solidarity Encampment, and demanded that the university divest from Israel. Students were met with police force, and many faced suspension, expulsion, and eviction from campus housing. Pro-Palestinian student protesters continue to face escalating backlash under the Trump administration.
On April 27, 2024, an indefinite encampment was set up on McGill's lower field by McGill and Concordia students, who chose the location as the visible center of the McGill campus. And in its first 2 days, the encampment tripled in size, attracting students and community members who sought to end their university's complicity in the ongoing genocide in Palestine.
My name is John. I'm also a McGill student, and I was involved in the encampment this last summer. At the time, we saw this massive wave of escalation across the United States, starting, you know, as everyone knows, with Columbia, but sweeping throughout the country. And as the semester came to a close, it was a way of creating a popular space on campus where people could educate each other, and it had this sort of mass mobilizing effect because of the community that the space created. And so there was so much energy at McGill. I think we were receiving DMs and text messages hourly by people asking us to, from all all types of people, older people, younger people. Everyone was asking us when we were going to start ours. And I think it was just natural at the time to respond at this moment.
Smaller encampments were also formed at Université du Québec à Montréal, or UQAM, Université de Sherbrooke, Université Laval, and Square Victoria, throughout the duration of the McGill encampment, none lasting as long.
Voiced here by an actor, Sarah Chamy of Palestinian Youth Movement Montreal said this of the movement.
Columbia University really sparked the initial fire that really kind of erupted and became a movement on its own, where students have been answering the call to set up encampments. We're really seeing the student movement be on the front lines of this movement, which is for Palestinian liberation.
The encampment saw students occupying this space at McGill to leverage demands against both their administration and that of Concordia. These demands are: disclose. The McGill Board of Governors and the Concordia Investments Committee must fully disclose all investments in companies complicit in the genocide of Palestinian people. Divest. McGill and Concordia must fully divest from all complicit companies and cut academic ties with Israeli institutions. Defend. The university shall not pursue disciplinary charges against students taking action in support of Palestine and will drop any pending charges against students. And finally, declare. The universities must issue a statement condemning the genocide against the Palestinian people and pressure the Canadian government to cease all military contracts with Israel.
My name is Rama Al-Mallah. I'm a McGill student and I'm a student organizer with SPHR McGill. I think the encampment kind of came as like the culmination of like a year-long divestment campaign that was led by the students, and they were demanding, you know, divestment from these weapon companies that were directly involved in the genocide. And so it was a very tangible objective, a very rational objective, because of that material like bridge with the genocide. And the response of the community became to also heed the demands of the students and calling for divestment.
Calls for boycott, divestment, and sanctions of Israel, or BDS as it's more colloquially called, have been ongoing for decades, and universities have been called on to enact academic boycotts of ties to Israeli institutions, as well as divestment from funding that is directly tied to weapons manufacturing. According to a letter released by alumni of Concordia in January 2024, a few months before the encampment was set up at McGill, this latest escalation, which genocide scholars argue is a textbook case of genocide, is made possible by the complicity of Israeli academic institutions in developing weapons and surveillance technology, engaging in historical revisionism, and rebuilding legal and ethical justifications for Israel's crimes. They are an essential part of the material and theoretical infrastructure of dispossession in Palestine.
Essentially, the demands of the encampment were divestment from weapons companies that were like directly involved in either manufacturing like actual weapons that were being used on our people in Gaza, or some other involvement with the IOF.
According to a spreadsheet put together by the McGill Student Society, McGill invests about $20 million in companies with direct ties to Israeli apartheid, about half of which goes to weapons manufacturers, with the numbers actually increasing since 2023. Notable companies include Lockheed Martin, which supplies the Hellfire 9X missile, like the one that destroyed Al-Shifa Hospital, Safran, which provides equipment to Israeli police forces, Airbus, which exports military technology such as the Heron drone that surveys the Gaza Strip. Finally, RBC Bank, which has upwards of $58 billion invested in Palantir, a mass surveillance system that provides artificial intelligence tools to the Israeli military for surveillance of Palestinians.
The administration, you know, refused completely to engage with the demands in like a material sense and kept deflecting and like reorienting to like institutional mechanisms that we knew were a divergence and a distraction and had historically like failed the student body.
While McGill and Concordia have both in the last few years committed to divesting from fossil fuel companies, calls to divest from Israel have been met with more resistance.
The reality is the portfolio of money we're asking McGill to move is only around $7 million worth of weapons investments. Portfolios of this size can be moved at almost any time and reinvested in ethical alternatives. In an ideal world, McGill would divest tomorrow.
The university quickly set about attempts to dismantle the encampment, with McGill's vice chancellor, Deep Saini, announcing that the encampment was unsafe and that they were trying to de-escalate the protests and demonstrations. However, students remained adamant in their occupation on campus.
You know, McGill was desperate, and they started off with this tactic of intimidation with emails, with stuff like this. I mean, I remember distinctly a moment when the dean of students at the time, Robin Beach, came down. He spoke to me, actually, and he had an eviction notice for the camp. And this was on the first week of the camp, and he wanted me to read the eviction notice. And we told him at the time that he had to read it to the camp. And he got up, we gave him a megaphone, and he read out this long eviction notice. And I think people started chanting and booing and singing so loudly that we couldn't even hear the notice. And I think those sorts of moments just revealed to McGill that this tactic of intimidation or fear was not enough to dissuade students, and they would need to resort to discrediting us in other ways, since they flat out refused to engage with our simple demand for divestment, we found that they were too beholden to their donors' interests or political interests to even consider this question. And so what happened was a campaign of discrediting us, and I think the injunction was one of those things, as was Deep Sandy's opinion piece. It was really, at the time, like a scramble for them to fight back against this popular narrative that the encampment itself had created, and it was so widespread. I mean, throughout all of North America, I think we saw people coming out in support in ways that we'd never seen before. And so it was a really victorious moment, and we would read those emails at the camp and laugh about them, because it was a feeling of having won and seeing our administration clawing at whatever credibility they had left.
On April 30th, two McGill students actually attempted to file an injunction request against the encampment, asking to ban protests within 100 meters of McGill buildings for a 10-day period. They claimed that words circulating around and within the encampment were creating a hostile and unsafe environment, but the request was quickly rejected.
On May 2nd, a counter-protest in support of Israel is organized on Sherbrooke Street, so just outside of the Roddick Gates, where the entrance to McGill campus is. And this led to a heavy police presence on campus and the closure of the Roddick Gates entrance. The counter-protest lasted for a few hours, and there are no major escalations between the two groups.
Quebec Premier François Legault released a statement claiming that the encampment is illegal and that police must move in and dismantle it.
On May 10th, McGill requested an injunction itself against the encampment, but this was rejected 5 days later, coinciding with Nakba Day, on the grounds that it was ill-founded and did not demonstrate an urgent enough need to dismantle it.
There was two injunctions that were actually filed against the encampment. The first one was by, you know, students who were claiming that it was anti-Semitic and it was declined. And then the second one that McGill had filed, and it was like a historic legal victory that it was also declined. And the judge himself had framed this encampment as part of a broader student struggle against the crimes that the Zionist regime was committing against our people in Gaza. And so this narrative that the encampment had created was actually so strong that it played a role in actually allowing this unprecedented legal victory.
Despite several requests for police intervention, Montreal police were initially saying that the encampment was a civil dispute and they didn't yet have a legal basis to intervene. The university quickly filed a second injunction attempt, this time claiming that the campus was being violated as a private property. Meanwhile, protesters organized family-friendly teach-ins, workshops, and other programming activating the space.
We had daily programming. In the evening, we probably had a film screening. The Muslim community would do their khutbahs on Friday, outside. It was a beautiful sight.
In late May, attempts at bargaining with the university continued to be made, but were ultimately walked out on by protesters who felt that the administration was not coming to discussions in good faith.
I think from the very first day we set up the encampment, what we saw was a tactic from McGill of fear. You know, the first day we were receiving notifications that it was illegal to be on campus, even if you were a student and camped there. We were receiving emails that said that the encampment was violent and anti-Semitic, and this was from day one. And this just continued to escalate and continued to escalate. We had administrators come down and single out organizers, sometimes myself, and threaten them explicitly with arrest, with legal persecution. We had them threaten police intervention publicly, they served eviction notices, and when students responded to this by rallying even harder and communities came out in support of this encampment even more, and it became clear that this is not something that was going to go away and that people were educating themselves on McGill campus in a way that runs counter to everything McGill stands for and teaches, I think they shifted to negotiations as a tactic of stalling us or trying to sort of undermine or co-opt or sabotage what the encampment stood for. And so one of these strategies was, at a certain point, they publicized negotiations and they publicized a proposal that we had rejected. And this proposal said, I mean, if I remember correctly, that they would consider the question of divestment at their BOG meeting in what was at that point 6 months' time. And in fact, they did go through with that. And we saw that that meeting happened. They considered the question of weapons divestment, and they almost unanimously voted no to that question. So the reason we didn't accept these proposals is because our thinking at the time and to this day, our thinking is that it is not on the student body to determine the bureaucracy of divestment.
I'll also add, at the same time that we had the negotiations, they had filed an injunction against the students. And so they were dragging their students through court while publicly stating that they were engaging in these negotiations in good faith.
A report released by McGill on May 29th stated that none of this is peaceful protesting. It is designed to threaten, coerce, and scare people. It is completely unacceptable. In each case, we have reported what has happened to the police and urged them to act. Communications from McGill were flush with defamation of the encampment in the most time-honored fashion. Deep Saini said that few people from the McGill community were actually in the encampment, and that most protesters were activists from external groups, and that unhoused people were also using the camp, claiming that there had been drug use and a rat infestation.
Zayad Abisab of SBHR Concordia said in The Breach, "We have members of the elderly community, we have children, we have people from all different walks of life, and different communities altogether, keeping each other safe, keeping each other secure, and keeping each other healthy."
And we saw, you know, the Arab and Palestinian and, like, broader Muslim community, like, across the city. And, you know, you had community that was supporting materially. You know, you had older Arab women who were cooking for the students. You had others that were hosting programming. And so the mass character of this encampment really, like, came out. And you saw all sectors of society kind of come together and, like, pitch in, you know, in whatever way they could to sustain the encampment for as long as it lasted.
I'll also add that there was so much community support and you know, we saw every day there were families. It became a public family space at McGill, and that was wonderful, and the material support was wonderful. But also within the student movement, we saw a community form that was much more unified and broad than I think the methods of organizing, the style, the tactics that were used previously had allowed. And so students who supported this but didn't know how to get involved were rallying behind the encampment, were camping there, were spending their summer sleeping there. And we connected as well, I think all of us, with the Montreal community outside of the bubble of Anglophone McGill. You know, UQAM was there, there were UDAM students there, and it formed a student community as well.
On June 6, student protesters barricaded themselves inside the James Administration Building as a result of McGill's continued investments in genocide and in response to calls to escalate in the face of increased bombings occurring in Rafah at the time.
As McGill administration was blocking the negotiations, the situation in Gaza was getting worse. Like, it's still catastrophic, but there were escalations on the ground. The community also took up this demand, and you had autonomous groups that were organizing actions. So you also see this sort of growing frustration, but also growing, like, commitment and people just really heeding the demands of the students, essentially.
Police were called in, using tear gas and pepper spray on the protesters, while also charging at them with shields, pushing them away from the building towards Roderick Gates. The protesters were escorted from the building, and 15 people were arrested the following day.
That was the first time at McGill that we saw that kind of police violence with batons and tear gas and pepper spray. A group of students went into the James Administration Building. They went to the one of the top floors where the offices are and the meeting rooms. They occupied those meeting rooms, and they hung banners outside the windows. And the response was immediate, and it was incredibly brutal. There was a large protest outside of a few hundred people, and riot cops came in almost instantly. They barged into the building. They arrested everyone inside the administration building and charged them very severely with criminal charges. And then outside the building, they tried to disperse the crowd. And when the crowd stayed in support, they resorted to violence. And so a lot of people were hurt that day. But the violence we've seen since, it hasn't deterred students from protesting. And if anything, galvanizes people even more.
On the 11th of June, McGill presented revisions to their initial offer. But this was still refused by student negotiators, who stated that they would not leave until the university ends its investments connected to Israel's military and cuts ties with Israeli institutions. The offers made included an accelerated timeline into examining investments into companies who manufacture weapons, increasing links with scholars from Gaza and the West Bank, for example, leveraging the Scholars at Risk program, which supports Palestinian scholarship, and publicly listing the companies in which McGill has equity holdings under $500,000. Any amounts above that are already available to the public.
By June 18th, McGill said it was done with negotiating and blamed students for not acting in good faith or being willing to compromise on their demands. Saini declared that the university would only pursue disciplinary action from that point on.
Student reps emphasized that there had been a clear option for peaceful resolution to this encampment since the first day, a material plan for divesting from companies that are complicit in the illegal occupation and war crimes being committed by Israeli forces, as well as academic boycott of Israeli institutions. The proposal McGill laid out did not set out a pathway to divestment. Rather, it hinted at an increased transparency and a commitment to review, promises that student organizers found far from sufficient.
SBHR Concordia, who've had their club status suspended since June 2024, demanded that the Board of Governors mandate the McGill Investments Office to divest from all companies complicit in the genocide of the Palestinian people, including the over $20 million currently invested in weapons manufacturers, and that McGill and Concordia University publish a statement immediately condemning the ongoing genocide against the Palestinian people.
The way that admin was responding also kind of, as John was saying, like allowed us to see how they were just scrambling. There was also these contradictions that were being exposed where it's like they paid like almost $1 million, right, to move convocation. They could have just answered the demands of the students for free and like avoided paying all of this money. But it became so like ideologically entrenched that.
Yeah, this is another really important aspect of the desperation and the repression we saw, is it came from the fact that, as Rama said, they were losing money every day. The encampment was there. They spent millions of dollars on legal funds during the encampment. They hired an elite surveillance firm called Circo to help dismantle the encampment and surveil it during the day and night and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. They hired multiple PR firms at apparently very high rates. And like Rama said, they moved convocation to the Bell Center, which is normally supposed to be on the airfield. Mm-hmm. All of these things cost extraordinary amounts of money. And on top of that, access to information requests done by students since the encampment have revealed that donor pressure at the time was also extraordinarily high. And donors were actually backing out or threatening to revoke their donorship to McGill if the encampment went on any longer. And so they were desperate, and they really felt at the time that they couldn't divest because of this donorship, but also that they were losing money day by day by day that we stayed there. And so I think this is part of what kept students so motivated at the time, is we knew that even though our demands weren't getting met, we were having an effect.
On July 10th, 2024, McGill dismantled the encampment.
This is a final warning. Serve! Yeah! Unless you immediately comply with the instructions we gave you earlier, we will now consider other options to ensure that our instructions are followed, including seeking assistance from the police. Nous allons maintenant envisager d'autres options pour nous assurer que nos instructions sont suivies, y compris la demande d'aide auprès de la police. C'est le dernier avertissement.
At this point, they had not yet been granted an injunction, despite attempting for a second time to get one to remove protesters. This made it contentious as to whether or not they had the legal right to evict protesters. They hired the private security company Circo to evict protesters and destroy the encampment. So tents were picked up and crushed by machines, and anyone who was resisting was threatened with arrest.
There was no legal justification. The dismantlement was actually illegal. It was like contradicting the order of the injunction, which was...
It was still pending at the time.
Exactly. And like John had mentioned, they had hired like a private like security firm to essentially like dismantle the encampment, and they had arrested the people that were still inside. They had assaulted the students that were still inside and basically just dismantled the camp like illegally and destroyed everything.
Despite the encampment being dismantled, the fight by Montreal students to adopt a BDS or boycott, divestment, and sanctions motion continues.
In March 2024, UCAM became the first university in Canada to have all of its students' unions adopt BDS mandates against Israel.
This was such a historic moment, and I think everybody knew that this encampment was a tactic, essentially, and it was going to end either way. And I think the fact that McGill went to such lengths to like illegally dismantle an encampment honestly showed just how much power it had and how much power these students actually had. And we saw, like, the semester right after, like, students directly went back to continuing to organize. SP Charmigil at that point had been suspended as a club from their student union, again, because of pressures from admin. They pursued students with disciplinary charges, and that did not deter any of the organizing groups. Quite on the contrary, like, we see now the coordination between all of the universities being incredibly strong, and that's a direct consequence of the encampment and the coordination that was there. We see the bridges between the student community and the broader citywide community being much more present, being much more evident and defined. On November, so like a few months after the encampment, 80,000 students went on strike for Palestine. Like, it was historic. So we're still seeing this continuation, this consolidation, this accumulation of experience, of knowledge, coalition building, and more coordination between the universities.
In November 2024, 11 student associations representing over 11,000 Concordia students voted in favor of a two-day strike, making up part of the nearly 85,000 students from across Quebec who went on strike for Palestine on November 21st and 22nd. And on January 29th, 2025, Concordia undergraduate students voted on two motions: for the Concordia Student Union, or CSU, to adopt BDS demands, and for the union to bring those demands to the Board of Governors. This vote passed by nearly 94%, with 885 students voting in favor of the motions.
The President and Vice Chancellor Graham Carr released this statement the following day.
Dear Concordians, I write to you following yesterday's special general meeting of the Concordia Student Union adopting a motion on BDS. Concordia's position in relation to such boycott campaigns has been consistent for years and has not changed. Such campaigns are contrary to the value of academic freedom upon which all universities are founded. Beyond the vote itself, reports from yesterday's meeting are deeply troubling. They include the presence of heavily masked individuals, complaints of discriminatory behavior, and the use of intimidation tactics. This behavior is unacceptable on campus and contravenes our policies. The university has no input on the motions presented by the CSU or on its deliberative and decision-making processes. But we will examine the behavior around and at the special meeting and urge those who have complaints to report them.
This response highlights the institution's continued allegiance to Israel, smokescreened as neutrality, and framing of pro-Palestinian activism as violent, echoed in statements made by McGill in the response to the encampment last year.
Experience has taught us that maintaining a neutral institutional stance best supports as a whole our 50,000 members who hold varied political views, represent diverse identities, origins, and beliefs, and ardently espouse various causes.
Canadians for Peace and Justice in the Middle East released a letter following Graham Carr's statement, calling it defamatory and arguing that BDS is actually essential to academic freedom, not a barrier to it, citing the scholasticide that has seen Palestinian universities raised. In this letter, it is written that absent from your statement is any recognition of CSU's democratically organized special general meeting, nor acknowledgement of the legitimacy of its process. Despite the student body's overwhelming support for BDS, your statement vaguely refers to the democratic process as behavior at a recent student meeting, unfairly delegitimizing and casting suspicion over the proceedings.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
There was a lot of support from Indigenous communities, such as the Mohawk Mothers. What message does this solidarity between Indigenous communities and the people of Palestine convey?
I mean, I think that was one of the most important things for the encampment going into it. And we were actually in contact with some of those local Indigenous rights groups, like the Mohawk Mothers, who have their own legal struggle with McGill about them currently constructing the new Royal Vic on unmarked graves. In a certain way, the solidarity was natural because beyond the sort of like the question of indigeneity between Canada and Palestine and the comparisons between both settler colonial states, at McGill specifically, there was this natural enemy, shared enemy in a way. And so the solidarity itself formed very naturally. Ellen Gabriel was there on the first day. I think she was there as soon as we set up. She gave a speech to all the campers who were there.
I welcome you to the land of my ancestors, my homeland still, the Ganyatohaga people. On this and ceded land. This belongs to us, not McGill, but to the whole Australian people. The craziness of this institution to put an injunction against the students, the leaders of the future, was not agreed upon, and that you are welcome on our land, the Haudenosaunee people's land. We cannot stop until McGill ceases being part and Concordia, ceases being complicit in the genocide that is happening to our brothers and sisters over in Palestine. We must not stop, because there are so many lives at stake. And as an Indigenous person, someone whose ancestors survived genocide and continues to deal with the colonization of Canada, I can tell you that what you are doing here today is uplifting to those who are behind the barricades. And I have brought for you this women's warrior flag, because it is the women that hold title to the flag.
In support, flags were flown side by side with Palestine flags throughout the encampment.
When the encampment was set up, the Mohawk mothers had actually like gave us their like official blessing or like permission to be there, right? Because we were essentially on like their land. And I remember it being such a significant moment. And even when the injunction was declined and we were given almost like legal permission to stay, like it didn't mean more than like having the permission of like the Indigenous community there, allowing us to be on their land and kind of wage our struggle from here.
ريت المركب اللي اخذوا مرضوا يبلى بكسروا وبنار عقدوا.
After the encampment, we've also seen a sort of like accumulation of the sort of tactics that are used to protest in Montreal. And so that's come as a result of the repression faced from McGill and from the SPVM and from Montreal in general. But what it's resulted in is people with now a year and a half of experience who are able to push the boundaries of what protesters look like in Montreal. Mm-hmm. And these things often have more sort of direct responses from McGill. They engage people in different ways. I think this year we've seen a lot of class pickets happen. We saw a massive strike at Concordia. And so I think what activism or protest for Palestine looks like has completely shifted its scope since the encampment. And I think that's one of the largest
victories.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
My name is Ziad Abisaab. I'm a history student at Concordia, and I'm the ex-SPHR general coordinator and member of the Palestinian Youth Movement. And I was an organizer and a representative of the McGill encampment. After like a year of passing BDS motions in our faculty associations and organizing walkouts and sit-ins and protests, the administration still hadn't responded to our mass mobilizations, and the students at McGill and Concordia decided to take it a step further and to make a more urgent form of protesting, which was an encampment. It was also a response to the encampment movement in the U.S. that started at Columbia, and with the repression in the U.S., it kind of encouraged students here to do the same.
Can you compare the repression in the U.S. versus repression here?
In the U.S., the police was very, very violent. They arrested people, I know, for the encampment in Colombia. Within the first day or few hours or first few days, there was at least 100 students arrested, if not more. Same at NYU, same at Yale, same across the U.S. Here, we had a different engagement with the police, where the police did not see us do anything violent or that needed an urgent response or anyone to be arrested. As time went on, like at one point, there was 150 people sleeping in the encampment, and there was 300 people, 400 people on a daily basis showing up.
And what can you tell me about the setup? How did the first day of the encampment go?
First day of the encampment was, in my opinion, the best day. Everyone had very low expectations. We thought we were going to be swept within the first hour. People were prepared to be arrested. People were stressed and panicking. And initially, a group of around 60, 70 people snuck onto campus with a bunch of stuff. And we timed it with the PYM protest on the Saturday, which came to support. So by the time a few tents were up and people were locking arms on the campus, the protest was nearing its arrival. And when the protests and the campers merged, it was a really like, it was a feeling of success and kind of everyone felt a bit better and safer. And then when the night time came, everyone was very like alert and committed, and you just felt that everyone there like was giving their 100% to the movement and the cause. It was just the feeling of success. By the very second day, or on the day of, we start to see like a lot of these students, their parents showed up, their families showed up, you know, community members showed up to donate either food, blankets, pillows. There was a professor group that would come and wash people's clothes and dry them. It was really well supported by the community. By the second day, we had a surplus of things. It was instant, and then they would show up, and then they would, you know, sit with us, and they would support, and they would constantly check up. At one point, they asked us if we needed community members, like we're talking about 60, 70 year old people, to do night watch. It was a special relationship with the community, the encampment.
And how is the inside of the encampment managed?
We had a kitchen, we had a library, we had a tent where we all would talk and inform what was happening, what was going on. And we had an irrigation system, we had a door system, we had emergency exits. You know, we had people that were tasked to do various things. Some people were tasked to take care of the kitchen, some people were tasked to dig trenches, some people were tasked to build fences, some people were tasked to do scouts or security at night. And then when the popular university came along, we had a full team of teachers to teach various courses. I taught two courses.
Can you tell me about the popular university more? Like, what was the objective behind that?
Well, I had taught a few internal popular education sessions for SPHR Concordia last year, and they were very popular. And actually, the day that the encampment started, April 27, was the last day of our session, our internal education session. And I wasn't able to finish it because of the encampment. Then I'm like, you know what? Why don't we make it a program?
Can you tell me about the program a little bit more? Like, what topics did you explore?
We started off with, if I'm not mistaken, the state of the Palestinian resistance before the creation of the Zionist state, the 1938 revolts. I mean, the first week was basically about the Palestinian resistance, if I'm not mistaken. The second day was about the PLO, the creation of the PLO. And then the third day was, I taught about the rise of Pan-Arabism with Gamal Abdel Nasser and the wars that happened. And then the course after that was about Oslo, about the setback of Oslo. At the fifth day, we talked about the present day resistance, post-2000. Thought about the Nakba, we thought about the media, we thought about the Zionist state is different than other colonial projects in the past, where it suggests that the settler colonial people are actually the indigenous people. They are actually the indigenous people that are like liberating their own land. And this definition gives this legitimacy to them. This allows them to say that no, the Zionist colonial project represents Judaism. It doesn't. This was created. Judaism was alive and existed way before the creation of the Zionist state. And if this is a fabrication on their end to try to create a nationalist identity among the Jewish people.
Now, you mentioned the media being part of your program. What did you think of how the media dealt with the encampment?
Honestly, the coverage was way better than we expected. CBC made an in-depth look into our demands to like debunk the idea that like, oh, our demands are not realistic. And they said the truth. They said like, yeah, no, McGill and Concordia are invested or complicit with weapons companies, and the students want this to be removed. A lot of allied media also, you know, we're very grateful to them. They gave us like constant platforming. At one point with what happened was, you know, even when we were taken to court multiple times and in multiple injunctions against us failed. The coverage was great. They addressed the failures very well. But then towards the popular education and the popular university, a lot of the news outlets started to run with the Zionist narrative. Somehow the encampment was dangerous because we were having popular education there.
What does this solidarity between indigenous communities and
the people of Palestine convey?
First and foremost, we need to, you know, recognize that we're here and we cannot play the role of a settler. Canada is a settler state. If we are not fighting against the settler colonialism of Canada or the US, we're complicit. We're not standing with the indigenous people here. And if we're not standing with them here, it's hypocritical to ask people to stand with our indigenous people in the Arab world that are also victims of settler colonialism. So it's a priority to establish that whatever we do here is one with the approval and with the support and in solidarity with the indigenous people in their struggle against the colonial state here. And, you know, we it's part of a larger movement against imperialism. Directly responsible for the creation of the Zionist settler colonial project.
Now, there were a lot of activities held in the encampment other than the popular university, but like everyday activities like kite making, you know, Arabic calligraphy. And why was it important to hold these activities? What environment did these foster?
First, a sense of community, and it also helped us have all ages. There was kids, there was adolescents, you had students and university students, sejab students, you had parents, you had grandparents, and other things, maybe they're less accessible to a wider range of people, but having all of these programs in this encampment helped us really like cater to everyone.
Just, I want to talk a bit about who was involved in the encampment. I know this was, it was set up in McGill's Roger Gates, but in terms of the students that were involved in it, from which university students were involved?
Yeah, I mean, there were for sure, of course, there were a lot of McGill students. I would say a majority were McGill students, but we had a good chunk of Concordia students there. At one point, there was the UCAM students before they went off and made the UCAM encampment. You know, various Cégeps, Dawson, Maisonneuve,
yeah.
Vanier.
And why was it important for all these students to join forces?
There was a global student intifada happening in the West. We saw in almost every single country in the West, there'd be an encampment set up. Ours is actually one of the longest standing. It was like maybe top three longest standing encampments. It was the first one in Canada. And, you know, Montreal plays a very important role in activism in general in the West. You know, it's well known. So the McGill one is a very important encampment, and it represents something for the student movement globally. So all the students here in Montreal, not just the university students, all the students saw it as like, okay, this is our duty here.
Now, what was the process of dismantling the encampment? What justification was given, whether legal or not?
They made an injunction, and the next time they could visit the decision of the injunction was going to be on July 26th, if I'm not mistaken. And the encampment was dismantled on July 10th. Why did they do this? Is because they realized that the injunctions that they filed in court would not pass. And it's even if they wanted to pass, they cannot do anything until the next hearing. So our victories in court prolonged our encampment. Mm-hmm. So McGill basically saw that, okay, well, the law doesn't suit their what they want to do. And they hired mercenaries, Circo, to enter the camp, basically threaten everyone in the camp. They got dogs and private investigators and riot teams and I don't know what. And then they threatened everyone in the camp and threatened everyone to leave. Most people left. Those who stayed were detained, some were arrested, some were brutalized, and then they just demolished the encampment, which is blatant like disregard for the rights of their students, and it was a blatant disregard for the decisions of the courts at the time.
What about the demands of the encampment? Were they met in any way?
They were not met, no.
How does the work continue now?
I think ever since the encampment, we've seen something rise that kind of has the same mass character as the encampment, which is the strike. The strike in November was history, just like the encampment was. But it was kind of a bit different, and in my opinion, a bit better. Because the encampment happened because people felt this sharpening contradiction and urgent need to take action because of what was happening in the US. Mm. For the strike, it came out of like really just motions that people submitted. And it created a domino effect. Students wanted to like translate all the popular mobilizations that happened for the past 2 years into something. And when they passed the motions, that initially they passed BDS motions, and the encampment is a good example where the administration didn't meet the demands. Students were like, okay, we need to do something else now. You know, we've protested, we've done sit-ins, we've done walkouts. The last thing left is a strike. Students decided to make history and go on strike. And we reached 85,000 students on strike in November, which was historical. This has never happened in Montreal ever. Students have never gone on strike for Palestine. And this is how the struggle continues, is through the unions and the strike. The student movement has really evolved, and our unions are slowly becoming actual unions.
My name is Ali Salman. I am a Concordia student. I am part of the Concordia Student Union Council. I have been involved also in the encampment. I was media rep during the encampment.
Can you introduce your understanding about how the student encampment formed and what it did?
Yes, the mass mobilization that came as a consequence of the encampment, it really turned the tides on the universities. For ages, even for the first half of this genocide, when people spoke of divestment, no one knew what it was. So after that, it changed, because now you can speak to people, to any student, to any person about divestment, and they will know what it is. And that was essential in changing not only the mobilization and the popular opinion on the student, but that was essential in putting pressure on the administrations and then eventually sustain it for the months to come. And it was very well sustained by the students. We saw that a lot of the rallies they called in the past semester, they managed to mobilize thousands, not only on the strike rallies, but on the rallies that came in October and September. That was the turning point. The fact that the encampment defined what divestment was, not only in Montreal, but also in North America, was what really changed and turned the tides on the universities.
What are some examples of the kinds of repression that the university has enacted in response to, for example, the strikes, but also in clashes at the encampment?
When it comes to McGill and Concordia, I mean, they both hired new security firms. But for Concordia, they hired an even more outrageous security firm, the Perceptage. The Link released an article not long ago showing what Concordia paid for Perceptage. They really went and paid to get Perceptage, which is literally the IDF and mercenaries, along with other mercenaries that served in other parts of the world, to come on campus and repress students with the blessings of administrative bodies such as the Dean of Students. And seeing this repression come to the point where you have to bring literal Canadian Army soldiers or IDF or mercenaries on your campus in order to shut down. Well, on a positive note, it shows that they are feeling the pressure. They know what they're doing is wrong, but they're doing it anyway because, you know, they just want to shut down students and repress them as much as they can, mm-hmm. and to please their donors, I guess.
In the next phase of Palestinian liberation and how the Solidarity Movement operates at Concordia and beyond, where do you see this kind of changing and developing?
The students have their own fight, and it involves the Palestinian liberation. I do think that it is quite embedded now in the student bodies of universities around North America, not just in Concordia and McGill, that I believe that it's going to continue in a very, very strong way. And it's not going to go back to the point where they did after 2014, where they just completely killed it off. I mean, I think it's just impossible.
Yeah, we hear a lot of thinkers or commentators or Palestinians talk about Gaza being like a window. Anyone who has any kind of connection to imperialism, if they didn't see it before October 7th, like there's much more people who kind of understand that this is much broader than like a war.
Yeah.
The organizing that's happened over the past year, obviously, even though it's been going on for decades, mm-hmm. it's kind of changing the conversation from not just about human rights or protecting rights to territory, but that it's more about the sort of global kind of like scales of how settler colonialism is kind of like maintained. And I hope that you're right as well, and that it sort of crossed the threshold into something else. Yeah. Can you speak more about the kind of organizing that's happening on campus today?
The organizing of the student movement definitely, I think, changed from the encampment onwards. As we see right now, for example, last semester at Concordia, there has been many rallies that were organized, whether it's by SBHR, it was mainly by SBHR, but there was other people who also organized rallies and did actions around Concordia. And we see that this mobilization of people in the student movement has grown beyond grassroots, and the 11,000 students that went on strike in Concordia speaks to it. So many associations and federations are getting involved in BDS and getting involved in striking for BDS and taking action for BDS.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM. 1690 AM.
I remember the first time I went to the encampment, and when I got there, I just remember seeing so many people outside, like families playing with their children. It was like a park almost. I even got a little tour inside. And the thing that drew my attention the most was the library. It was like beautifully set up, and I would just remember seeing like people just sitting on the chairs and reading like in their own little corner. And I felt like intern is space for like education, for creativity, and for community. Like, it was really beautiful to see.
Yeah, I remember they started, when they were posting updates, like they started just saying day three at the free school.
Yeah.
You know, because it was like, this space is no longer McGill. This is a space of a different kind of education, different kind of community and solidarity. Yeah.
They were even doing Dabke the first few days or weeks. They even did a Dabke workshop, which I thought was really cool. Dabke is like a very significant dance for the Levant, like the whole Levant region. But you see that especially in Palestine. And I thought that was like very meaningful to see.
What about you, Piper? What is your memory of this time?
It was cool to see like a lot of my profs at the Profs for Palestine zone, and, you know, really feeling like my academic community is also part of my like activist community.
Yeah, totally. My own memories of the encampment were kind of like what both of you said. It felt really nice as somewhere that no matter what time of day, if I had a few hours, it was like, I'm just going to bike down there. I might go with a friend, be like, oh, I'll meet you on the way. Like, we'll bike down St. Urbain, whatever. Or I'll just kind of show up and like, I'm sure I'll know someone. Or even if I don't, there's an assumption that you share some kind of orientation to the world that makes you feel maybe safer than if you're just like showing up anywhere else in the city. And I remember that I think when I went on the second day, there was a signal group of here's all the supplies that we need. And I remember showing up with a bunch of random like hardware stuff for my house.
Yeah, it felt really well coordinated in groups I was in, like Musicians for Palestine. Someone I feel like was almost always there from that group. And so giving live updates of like, oh, don't bring cooked food today. Like there's too much cooked food. And
yeah, donations were were overwhelming, especially the first week. But yeah, back onto that point that you just said, like, you know, Musicians for Palestine, Teachers for Palestine, that's another like aspect of the encampment that I think is very important, how everybody came together for that singular cause. And it just shows how much unity plays a crucial role in the Palestine movement in general.
Do you feel like that's something that petered out or disintegrated with the dismantling of the encampment? Or do you think that it's sort of just alchemized into something else?
I think the encampment helped people get involved more in the movement. I feel like a lot of people like came at the beginning, they didn't know anyone, they were not sure how they could help, what they could do. But after the encampment, everybody met a lot of people, everybody became more involved, joining the Palestinian youth movement. Students began like joining SBHR and all of that. And I think that the encampment created connections that strengthened that unity between people. And I'm pretty confident that the work that they do eventually will pay off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like something about the encampment, like you said, Sydney, it just being there and people being able to just like stop by does kind of really like invite people into the movement in a more accessible way.
That really makes a difference for someone who's maybe curious about like, okay, I've heard some stuff about Palestine. I maybe know a little bit about what's going on, but I'm not quite sure how to speak about it or like who to talk to if I want to get involved. I'm a little bit nervous. I might do something wrong. Just showing up and being met with a kind of like open arms, that's like quite difficult to do, I think, particularly on the left these days. So
did either of you go and participate in much of the programming, like the screenings or the teach-ins?
Yeah, I went to the screenings a couple of times, and I think these screenings were very important. And I think like anything media related is extremely important because it really like opens your eyes into like the reality of the situation. This is what it's all about. This is who we're fighting for.
I wondered if we could talk about the kind of underlying legal battle that played out of whether or not McGill had the right to get an injunction. Like, do these students have the right to be here? Like, the question of, are universities public spaces or are they private spaces? McGill obviously was coming from the position that this is a private institution, that we have a right to sort of dictate who is here. And it's funny because ironically, like when they asked the police to intervene, they wouldn't because they were like, well, this is a private institution. I think that there was also commentators who weren't so much on the side of the students who would say, like, you can't occupy a public space either, you know, like.
Yeah, it's complicated, I think, in Canada, where our universities receive public funding, private funding, and tuition funding. So it really kind of blurs that line of like, is it public? Is it private? Who owns it? And who has the right to be there? To me, students paying tuition, how can you kick them off of that and tell them it's private property and they don't have the right to be there when they're literally funding it? But then also, again, with the public funding, it's like, well, it kind of belongs to all of us. Like, every taxpayer kind of owns a little stake of it. And then you get deeper to like, and it's on unceded land to begin with.
Exactly.
So the university really doesn't, you know, they might have a legal right to it, but they don't actually have like an inherent right to it.
Yeah. McGill has a McGill has a very like colonial past as well, and indigenous communities came out and said, well, you know, this is our land and we allow encampment protesters to be here. So I think that just like cancels out all of that.
Yeah.
All of these little details. I think also McGill was just like deeply uncomfortable by what the encampment stood for. There was ATV set up on the like outside the encampment, and it had like, I don't know which channel it was, but it was just like basically like news from like Gaza, occasionally the West Bank as well, and like anyone who would pass by, like they would just see the images and like everything coming out of Gaza in front of them, like you can't escape it at all. And I think that just served as a reminder, you know, like this is what this is about, this is what it stands for. And if you think the demands are unrealistic, then this is why we're demanding these.
Yeah, I think though, to what you just said, Serena, like we come down to the actual demands and this idea of like divestment, and it's like, okay, money, but it's not really about the money at the end of the day. They could afford to divest, they don't want to.
Exactly. And this has been proven time and time again, especially Concordia allowing very racist and Islamophobic speakers on campus. And I think a few years ago, Graham Carr, he went to Israel. There was like this huge scandal of like, you know, him going there and basically using students' money to go there. And that sparked a lot of outrage.
Yeah, well, it's interesting how it's only going to get worse, I guess, in as we see astronomical tuition hikes and like universities to become more and more kind of concretized as these like neoliberal spaces that you pay into, that have the right to like protect their spaces with like a lot of force, only exacerbates university as this kind of corporate space that occupation is a threat to. And if university was like free, or if it was actually publicly funded, of course it doesn't mean that these debates would like disappear at all.
Yeah.
But I think it does really create a like a tension and a facilitation of violence, I guess. All of these things like go together.
Mm-hmm. And I think, like, again, people tend to forget the issue at hand is that, you know, all the companies that Concordia and McGill are invested in, all the internships that they offer, they're companies that manufacture weapons that go to Israel. And I think back to the encampment and summer youth program that they organized, this is why it was so important for them to organize a space like that, where they taught courses about Palestine without any censorship, without any silencing. And so that people can truly learn about the history that they could rarely access in their own institutions. And for them to know what they're standing for, you know? Obviously, like, people wouldn't expect people to, like, go into something so blindly and, you know. But you have all the information in front of your eyes.
One thing we didn't get to was the question of Jewish student safety on campus, which came up a lot in the media. You know, consistently, we heard reps themselves say that this is not an anti-Jewish organizing that they're doing, and that actually at the encampment, I remember witnessing Shabbat dinners that they would have, and there was a lot of like pro-Palestine Jewish activists who were really central to organizing and bridging solidarity, having a kind of like interfaith, interracial, intergenerational, whatever form of like activism and community.
Thank you to Zayed Abisab, Rama Al-Mala, John, and Ali Salman for their interviews. Our volunteers, Cassandra, Nikita, and Sophie for their work on this episode, to the CRFC Radio Meters program for funding Discordia, and a special thank you to our co-host for this episode, Serena Abujud.
Contact us at discordia@cjlo.com with questions or to get involved. You can find this episode in the archives at cjlo.com, SoundCloud, and Spotify.
Tune in on Monday, April 7th at 6 p.m. for our next episode on the 2024 tuition hikes and the ongoing fight against them.